sure everybody's familiar with the story. It doesn't hurt to read. We're going to study it now, not just read. Now, we've been reading three. This is the third in the series, I would say, because there's a common thread. We've been studying the Torah on an in-depth level, specifically pertaining to the development of man. The Torah depicts how man was in his original state and certain changes that were brought about due to man's faulty use of his power of choice. Since a person has choice, he's ultimately responsible for his own fate. That's a very basic foundation of the Torah. And so the very first change that's brought about takes place in the Garden of Eden, when Adam sins, and as a result of that, God effectuates a significant change in his nature, the creation of the element of conscience, which did not exist in the original state that he had been created in. And the second story, the story of the flood, as we understood the nature of the sin on a deeper level, we saw that there's a profound difference between the way man was before the sin and the way before the flood, and how he was after the flood. In terms of his physical makeup, his constitution, he was an extremely all-powerful type of a being, and that was the cause of the sin. The fact that he allowed this to go to his head and became extremely egocentric. And that's a very dangerous state. When a person gets carried away with his own ego, and you see this, of course, throughout history, so then he gets the sense that he's the master of the universe and he can just do whatever he pleases. This is the third in a series of fundamental changes. And I think that what might be surprising a bit is, in this particular story, the Torah gives us tremendous insight about a historical process that I don't think it's possible for historians to account for, as to why it should be this way, and touches upon an issue of concern in every generation, the issue of war and peace. Even though on the surface it's not talking about this. But if we look into it very deeply, as I said, the subheading of the topic tonight is, can there ever be peace on earth? Is that an attainable goal? That's something that's extremely, you know, interesting, of concern to us. In this generation, perhaps, in any generation, but in this generation more significantly, because with the advent of, you know, the nuclear weapons, we do have the capacity to physically destroy the universe. So the question of whether there can ever be peace, and does the Torah talk about this? Now that's what we're going to try and elucidate tonight. Now if you read the story superficially, I think it's very difficult to comprehend. It seems like a pleasant enough tale. As you read it, this takes place, of course, after the flood. And it seems like a very good state of affairs that the entire world spoke one language. And that's the way we expect it to be, since all the world had a common origin from one man, and whatever language they spoke, there was one language. So how do we account for the fact that today there's thousands of different languages? Well, the Torah is providing the account. It's really a metaphysical phenomenon. It's something which is brought about by God, although we're not sure what the reason is. And common purpose, that's the translation. In Hebrew, it's Devarim Achadim, which means that there was a tremendous degree of unity, that the agreement. And it came to pass when they migrated from the east, they found a valley in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them in fire. And the bricks served them as stone, and the whatever that is,
bitumen?
I don't know why they do that. Served them as mortar. So they made, basically they created the building blocks, which indicates that they seem to be involved in productive activity. They're working together as a team harmoniously. They're building, they have plans over here to build a city. And they said, come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and we'll make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed across the whole earth. That's the end of the description of what they did. And we can refer to it as, there's something sinful over here, there's something sinister, there's something evil going on, although from the surface it's not really clear what's the problem. They all spoke the same language, they were engaged in a cooperative productive activity, which the Torah is in favor of that. The Torah wants people to develop civilization. That was the blessing of God, that man should gain dominion over the animals of the field and to build societies and to be involved in scientific progress. Not to mention the tremendous degree of unity over here. Then, this triggers a reaction of God. God descended. The Torah uses that expression of descended, not that God goes up or God goes down, but it's, so to speak, a descent. When God has to intervene to correct the affairs of mankind because man has sinned, it's sort of like a come down, so to speak, because God would prefer that men would use their intelligence and act correctly. So God comes down to look at the city. By the way, this is also, there's many lessons that are derived from this. One of them is that God doesn't have to come down and look because God knows everything. But it's God is depicting himself, since he's in judgment, as always coming down and looking for himself. It's to teach a lesson to judges that they shouldn't judge from afar, shouldn't assume that they know the situation, but they should come and see for themselves. So God depicts himself as though he's coming down and looking to teach us a lesson. That we, before we arrive at significant decisions involving punishment, should come and take a look for ourselves. So God takes a look at the city and the tower which the sons of man had built. And Hashem said, behold, they are one people with one language for all, and they've begun to do this, and now should it not be withheld from them all that they propose to do? That is to say, and now there's nothing to hold them back from doing everything that they desire to do. Come, let us descend, and there confuse their language, that they should not understand one another's language. So, of course, it's not really clear. It seems that they're involved in doing something which is evil. And God is saying, if we don't put a stop to it right now, then there's going to be nothing to hold them back from doing everything that they propose to do, everything they want to do. But what do they want to do? Nobody knows what they want to do. But whatever it is, it's not good. So God decides that he's got to put a halt to this, and the way to do it, apparently, is to confuse their languages.
Can you
just close the
door?
Just want to build.
Because they want to build a tower, a city, with a tower in the heavens, and they want to make a name for themselves.
Okay.
That's what they want to
do. All right. But that doesn't sound so terrible.
No, they're
not. Oh, okay, fine. That's what I mean. They want to make a name for themselves. So who doesn't want to make a name for themselves?
Yeah.
Everybody wants to make a name for themselves. A good name, though. Well, today it doesn't make any difference. Any publicity is good publicity. No, I don't believe that. I'm just saying that's the philosophy. All right, so as I said, if you read the story, it's very difficult to figure out what is so terrible over here. But anyways, the solution to the problem seems to be that they have to be dispersed. So now they're dispersed. And Hashem dispersed them from there over the face of the whole earth. And they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because it was there that Hashem confused the language of the whole earth. And from there Hashem scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So basically, something comes into being at this point, and that is nationalism. Separate national entities with different languages. It's clear that that too is not in the natural scheme of things. We, of course, take it for granted that all statesmen and politicians have to deal with the phenomenon of nationalism, which can be a good thing, can be a very evil thing. That's probably the cause of all the contention, all the fighting in the world is basically because of nationalism. And statesmen from time to time have this notion of trying to create a world community. The League of Nations, after the First World War, failed. The United Nations today doesn't have real influence, is not really accomplishing. I mean, there's been just as much war and killing since the United Nations as before. So what's going on, though? Why did God see fit to bring this about? Now, a few years ago, a question occurred to me in trying to understand this, in trying to analyze this. I think it's very pertinent. And that is, what is the reason that this building project takes place at this particular time, at this particular point in time. That is to say, if there was this, you had the factor of one language, if this didn't come into being now, this is the way it was from the beginning of creation. So why is it, for example, that we read last week about the generation of the flood, which is before this? So why weren't they involved in this building project before? What is the cause that triggers this off at this particular point in time? Is it related? I always studied the story in isolation. I never studied in context as some type of a continuation of the events that occurred after the flood. But it occurred to me that that might be a helpful way to approach it. And we studied the flood last week, so I hope you remember the basic ideas that we arrived at. Before I proceed, does anybody have any thoughts, if you have any sense of where I'm going? Yes?
Well, I don't know about the question about what you have. If everything was destroyed in the flood, of course they're going to be building, they're looking to rebuild the city. But that would be a question, not be an answer why it's occurring now as opposed to before.
Yeah, but that's true. There's a need to rebuild, but even before, they never were engaged in this type of a building project. Whatever building they did was of a different kind. They weren't seeking to build this unified city with this tower that reached to heaven. It may be true, practically speaking, that there was a need to rebuild the world. But why didn't they rebuild the world the way it was built in the first place?
Basically going after Hashem or unifying themselves that it shouldn't happen again, but maybe not for the right reason.
That's a good point. They're on the right track. Go ahead.
I think that, well, the two factors. One, as it relates to the relationship to God, it shows them this trust of God, and that God effectively tries to wipe them out, and they don't trust that it won't happen again, and so they're unifying themselves to fortify themselves from being scattered and from possibly the scattering that they're fearing is not clear as to why they're concerned they might be scattered and dispersed across the earth, but I'm presuming that they may anticipate that may be the next type of punishment that might befall them, so they think they can combat that by unifying themselves.
Okay, but...
Also, you mentioned that the whole relationship of man to the world was different before the flood.
Good point.
They now have to be more dependent on things.
Very good.
Before they dominated the earth, now they don't, so there's this... Yeah. Need to react differently and bond together to combat the fact that their role is different than it was before.
Yeah, and I think that's basically what Aileen was getting at, and that is, we said that if you understand the nature of man before the flood, I would say that was the era of individualism. Each person was infused with such power and such might and such confidence. As we said, man was the most powerful of all the animals, and there was no need for God to place the fear of the animals in man. And that was the cause of the sin. The cause of the sin was this tremendous excessive egotism, but it was egotism as it manifests itself with regard to the individual. So to the contrary, each person felt like he was a god. He doesn't. That's a breach. He doesn't need other people. He doesn't need to band together. When a person is feeling very, very powerful, so then he tends to be extremely independent, then he doesn't want to be involved in groups. And because a group always requires the subordination of the individual ego to the needs of the group. That's what all groups have a problem with, eventually, all kinds of organizations, to the extent that people are willing to hold back on their personal ego and subordinate it to the needs of the group, to that extent it succeeds. But, you know, all kinds of problems emerge when the individual ego gets out of control. That's a problem for all organizations. In the generation of the flood, it would never have occurred to them to have this type of a unity. There was no need for it because they had a tremendous sense of independence and security. But as a result of the flood, man becomes an extremely weakened creature. And when people are feeling very weak, so what do? They band together. That's when people tend to band together because of their weakness and insecurity, and they sort of need each other. And that's where you see they're traveling, and the tremendous... The search over here, this was a reaction to the sense of weakness that comes into the picture as a result of the flood, the changes that have been brought about by the flood. You see it in all the times and places. You see it with the Jews, you see it with Israel, that when they're threatened, in moments of weakness, when they feel insecure, so then the Jews band together. And in unity, there's strength. But as soon as there's the danger is gone, and they're getting this feeling of superiority, so then all the divisions come into the picture, because then the individual ego becomes much more powerful. So what happens over here is that because of this factor, they band together, and they travel, and they're looking for a place, and they're looking to establish something that will give them a feeling of permanence. I think that's a good point, that they don't want to be wiped out again. And the solution will be build a city. And that will keep everybody together. It's very important to them to keep everybody together. And there's something that's very interesting about the city, because that in and of itself, up to this point, it doesn't seem to be such a terrible thing. It doesn't seem that there's any type of a crime involved or any kind of a problem in terms of God's purposes. The Torah never describes it explicitly what it is. We're going to have to infer it. But you do see that it's not merely a functional thing, a practical thing. But it becomes more than that. It may have started off that way, but it becomes more than that because it's a city with a tower with its top in the heavens. There's an important symbolism over there. The tower is not such a practical thing. The city is practical, but the tower is making some kind of a statement, and we're going to try and figure out what that statement is. And also, as Murray pointed out, and they wanted to make a name for themselves. Now that doesn't fit into the requirement of something which is practical. If it's practical, so then who cares about a name? What's the idea of a name? So those two things are sort of hints that we're talking about something which is more than just a matter of practicality. And that's what I want to elucidate tonight. To understand this story, I just want to familiarize you. The story is based upon a very deep insight into the psychological makeup of people. And you see the level of understanding that the Torah has in terms of psychology. So I want to just review certain principles, and then we'll apply them in terms of trying to figure out what the story is about. Take questions, but...
All right, I'll just make a comment over here. When the Torah is going to some length to tell us, you know, the fact that they're making bricks and putting them in the fire, they had some engineering experience, it seems like.
Right.
They're going to make a very strong city, which perhaps will not be able to be destroyed by another flood. And the concept of a tower, also, that's going to go to the heavens, of course, also may not be destroyed by another flood. So maybe that's the reason the way they make a name for themselves, because they'll be able to outlive or outlast any destruction that God may want to heap upon them.
Okay. Let's see how it works out. That's a good observation. There are certain psychological principles, and we're all familiar with the phenomenon of human aggression. I think it permeates the society that we're in. It's the century that we're in. I mean, much of the study of human affairs and human history has to do with man's aggression. And psychologists discuss the issue is that something which is innate? Because people try to, in order to deal with it, to try to curb it. So the question is that something which is a result that's learned? It's something which you learn? It's a result, something that you get from the environment? Or is it simply something which is innate? I would say that the Torah's view is that man is aggressive by nature. By the way, when we say that man is aggressive by nature, whenever you have that modification by nature, it means to say that there's nothing evil. A person, see, in our society, we're taught to repress certain things about our nature. Because it's not a Jewish society, it's more of a Christian society, and Christianity judges man as being good or evil by certain impulses. But Judaism doesn't look at it that way. All of the impulses, there's nothing evil about having a sexual desire. There's nothing evil about having appetite. There's nothing evil about having aggression. Man is aggressive by nature. And you don't have to, you know, take a look at the world. Take a look at our own society. Everybody. And there may be certain people that will deny it because there's a lot of guilt that's associated with it. But it permeates. I mean, even if it's done, there's nothing wrong with it. It can be channeled into good causes. God placed it within man to harness the energy. What motivates the people to achieve. You can see it in the world of business, you can see it in the world of politics, you can see it just turn on the TV. And you see the tremendous amount of energy that's involved in sports, for example. And every sport, in one way or another, is an involvement of the aggressive instincts, the desire to defeat the other side. In some countries, even in America, you see at very often at sporting events how it can break up into tremendous fights and people can get killed. Because when people are involved in combat, the sport is a form of combat. It's a civilized form, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. But a person has to recognize that there's a tremendous aggressive impulse in people. It may be difficult for people to accept, but if you're thoughtful and you're honest, you will notice it. You can notice it in very simple things. That is to say, for example, if there is a big accident, if there's an airplane crash, so then people will do anything to get to the scene, to witness, to observe it. There's a phenomenon called rubbernecking. Sometimes the traffic slows down for miles, and when you get there, there's an accident on the other side, so everybody has to stop and see. Now, of course, people will deny that it has anything to do with the fact that you may be taking a certain amount of sadistic enjoyment out of other people's suffering. That's something that people won't acknowledge unless they have a willingness to be honest. You see it even in ordinary social relations, in jokes, putting other people down. It's a sublimated thing. I'm only joking. But that's a attempt to gratify the aggressive instinct in men. So that's something which is there. And without it, without that, people would not be motivated to great accomplishments. The real task of a society is to be able to utilize all of these energies and direct them towards constructive purposes. And that's the factor which causes people to want to discover, to make a discovery, to build something, to be successful. Well, all of these things, you could tell when people achieve a great success and they win, that's the aggressive component. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with it, provided that a person does not seek to repress it and is dishonest about it, and provided there's positive channels. You could see it in Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos says that you should pray for the peace of the government. Why should you always pray for the peace of the government? We have a prayer in the Siddur for the peace of the government. Because if there was no government, what would happen? Each person would swallow up his neighbor alive, basically. That's basically what they say, that there's... And the Torah really advocates to a great extent that we should always support the authority of the government. Well, I'm not talking about a wicked government. Obviously, there's got to be a case where you draw the line. But you know I don't know if you remember the phenomenon of blackouts, when there was a blackout, and, well, when was the last blackout? I remember one in 73. And what happens when the lights are out? Ordinary, civilized individuals who you'd never expect of doing anything wrong are suddenly out in the street and stealing. And, well, what happened? These are civilized people. But people really maybe are not that civilized. At bottom, every person is capable, given the right circumstances, and this is what took place in Germany. After all, under the right circumstances, when you have the conditions that led to the advent of a Hitler and Nazism and a demagogue and so forth, he appealed and he evoked these very powerful, sadistic, aggressive emotions. Well, you know, I'm not saying it will happen in this society or that society, but that's basically the way people are by nature. That's why they say that without a government in place, so then people would be in a state of chaos. That's principle number one. Now, in spite of the fact, given this pessimistic evaluation of the nature of man, that man is so aggressive, you can see it in children, by the way. If you observe children, you see that it's natural. They like, you know, it's a natural thing to want to beat up on their brothers or sisters, their friends. It's a natural kind of thing, combat. It's a natural. Whoever's a parent will know this. You can observe it. But the point is, what a parent should do in that situation is the instinctive reaction is to try and make the kid feel guilty about it, that there's something wrong with that. You shouldn't hate your brother. You shouldn't feel that way. That's not the way to do it. Because you're just implanting a certain sense of guilt. And the best thing is just to separate, that you can feel any way you want to feel, but you can't do these kinds of actions. Better than to sort of make the kid feel bad about something of which he really has no control. He's just expressing his nature. As he grows older, he'll redirect these energies. But if he's made to feel guilty and repressed it, you can have all kinds of problems. Anyways, if that's the case, so then how do we account for the fact that there is a tremendous amount of what we would call compassion in the world? At the same time that you see that people are very, very aggressive and destructive, and yet we do see tremendous deeds of compassion. People, when there's an earthquake somewhere or in our society, I mean, look, that was a major theme of the campaign. Are we compassionate enough to the elderly and prescription drugs and so on and so forth? And in spite of all of the aggressiveness on the one hand, we do see a tremendous amount of compassion on the other. So what's going on over here? How do these two factors interrelate? There's one element that has the effect of neutralizing the aggressive component in man, and that is the factor of identification. Whenever you see, if you look into some of these charities, muscular dystrophy and all these charities that are supported by actors or successful people, and you ask them, why did you choose to get involved in cancer? Why did you choose to get involved in this thing? The reason always has to do with something personal. There was a personal involvement. A person had a close relative that was suffering from this disease, or a person themselves may have had that disease. So the question is, well, why is this particular cause more important than any other cause? And the answer they'll always give you is because there's some factor where they can identify with this. When a person can identify, you see you change. People will change in many different areas. People that were very hostile to certain types of things, people that were anti-gay or lesbian or this thing that. But when it happens to them, they have somebody in their own family that is experiencing the same thing, suddenly they take a totally different attitude towards the situation. They become much more compassionate, much more understanding. Whenever you have the phenomenon of identification, then that's why all the aggressiveness that is expressed against people that you can't identify with. That's the phenomenon of propaganda. Whenever a nation goes to war against another nation, it's preceded by a tremendous campaign of propaganda to dehumanize the other people. Whenever you have this phenomenon of dehumanization, so that paves the way. That's why all the propaganda in Nazi Germany about the Jews, the depiction of the Jews as being something evil, something sinister, all that is to break down the factor of identification. Because as long as you can identify with that person as a human being, so then it prevents you from acting out the aggression. I remember a story I read. I did a great deal of reading over the years about the Holocaust. This fascinating story about this individual who was deported. He was in the concentration camps, and everybody's being the Germans have no mercy whatsoever, and he was marked. He was set aside with a group that was going to be exterminated for whatever reason. I don't remember the particular reasons. And they were going down the line. This German was going down the line and, just sending each person off. Sending. He knew what the situation was. And it just turned out that this person, before he was deported, had been a boxer, a fighter. So he said that the German who was responsible, who was in charge, he could tell that he also was a boxer because, the way the nose is flattened out, one guy can recognize the other guy. So this German guy, who has absolutely no mercy, he's cruel, he's just sending off everybody to be killed, with no consideration, people are pleading, it doesn't mean a thing to him, he said he noticed, he looked at him, and he saw this guy's a boxer. Now the guy stops, the German stops, and he looks at him, and he's looking at the Jewish guy, and the Jewish guy is there without his clothes, he's ready to be shipped off to be exterminated, and he says to him, "Boxer?" So the Jewish guy says, "Yeah." So he paused, and he took him out of there, and he saved him. He put him in a work detail, and he saved his life. It's an amazing thing. It's a true story. That factor, you see, he couldn't identify with him as a Jew, because a Jew is a subhuman. But to him, he was a boxer. He had a boxer's pride. He could identify. He had found a basis to identify with him, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't exercise his aggression because he had a personal connection with the individual. That's an amazing kind of a thing. So, the story of the generation of the Tower of Babel, we could sort of understand now what's taking place. Bear in mind also that whenever a person has a powerful emotion, such as the emotion of aggression. And he can't express it in a direct way because it's bottled up in a direct way. There's always a need to find some kind of a substitute. If you can't express an emotion, displacement, this happens very often. Something that can happen on the job and somebody gets you extremely angry, but you can't talk back to them because it's your boss and you may lose the job. So you repress the anger, but the anger will have to express itself somewhere else. You may come home and get into an argument over something trivial, and no one can understand why you're so hostile. That's the displacement. That hostility needs to find an outlet. A very powerful instinct, which is prevented from being expressed directly, must find an outlet. Substitution, displacement, whatever you want to call it. Now, what happened over here, in my opinion, is that this building project began because the ego had suffered a blow. They were in a weakened state. There was a state of ego depletion in terms of the individual. So they banded together. And the objective was, at first, was, I think, innocuous, was to create a certain sense of security, which is okay. And they had this tremendous factor of identification with each other. And as they began to build the city, they began to feel a tremendous sense of strength. What comes into being over here is an entirely new phenomenon. It's called the group ego. This didn't exist before. There's a group ego. Today, we don't know that any person who's extremely egotistical cannot really satisfy his feeling from himself because the individual per se is too weak, so he's got to build. He's got Hitler, Yimach Shemo, was the head of the Third Reich. So the whole country, the whole entity is an extension of his ego, but in and of himself he's nothing. He needs to create an entity which is powerful. In his own mind, it's really him. And you could see the phenomenon of the group of you. That's the Olympics. If you're rooting for the United States, so that's you out there. We all feel very attached to Israel. If Israel is suffering, so it hurts us. It's the group ego. Israel becomes an extension of our own personal ego. When you're rooting for a team, what's the whole idea of a team? Why is it such a fanatical thing? Why does a person go into depression if his team loses? It's not you, it's other people. What does that have to do with you? The answer is because you've identified with them. So your ego is now tied up with the group. So what comes into being now is a new opportunity for that human ego to come back into the picture via the group. So now they begin to sense this tremendous feeling of egotism. And that's precisely what God had sought to address. The whole problem which brought about the sinning of the flood, that is, that man loses control over his instincts and he feels that he's the Lord of the universe and he can do whatever he wants to do and he doesn't have to be subservient to God. The problem was because of the power of the ego. And God had repressed that, but now it's finding a new way to express itself. It's coming out in the form of the group, the mighty group. Now, ego and aggression go hand in hand. The more egotistical people feel, the greater the extent, the way they express their aggression. They have less consideration for others and they have a greater sense of hostility. So something is happening over here. As they build the tower, they're getting a tremendous sense of power. And the city is no longer a practical thing. See, what you have over here is the forerunner of what we would call the nation of Amalek. It's a nation which is now involved in a process of the deification of man. That's what it means to build a city with its tower that goes up into heaven. It's a symbolic phenomenon. It is really an act of negation of the existence of God. It's to proclaim the supremacy of man. Because what happened was that they had this tremendous egotism. Now, where is the aggression going to be expressed? As we said before, let's not forget, aggression is a very powerful basic instinct of man. He must have an outlet for his aggression. Now, the normal target of aggression is other people. That's usually when you're going to take it out against other people. But as I said to you before, there's something which prevents you from expressing it against other people, and what's that? Identification. And we go back to the thing, the whole world was one language and common purpose. So they all identified with each other. They were all part of the inside group, so there was no opportunity to express that aggression against other people. So there was only one outlet. Where was the aggression directed? Against God. So mankind had now allowed itself to fall into a situation. By the way, the rabbis say that on the top of this tower, again, the statements of the rabbis can be taken literally. They don't have to be taken literally, but they're expressing their tremendous insight. They're saying at the top, what do you think was at the top of the tower? There was a sword that was pointed to heaven, which means to say it was an act. It was that's exactly what Amalek is about. It's the deification of man and the proclamation that man is the ultimate being on the earth and there is no God. It's a negation. It's a negation of God. Now, we're familiar with this type of phenomenon. Can you point to any society in recent history that would conform to this? Where the society, the group ego, becomes a substitute? The Soviet Union, communism, emphasizes this tremendous sameness, this tremendous unity. And whenever you have this type of a society, which proclaims itself as being the ultimate expression of human development, so that it's always going to be atheistic. It goes by nature. Whenever a society reaches the level where it proclaims itself as being godly, as being divine, so that's a negation of the creator of the universe. Now, isn't it interesting that they were involved in the building of the tower? It's the architecture. Great architecture, when people have this feeling of this sense of human supremacy, it always expressed itself in the building of tremendous architectural developments. There's an author, a woman, actually she's Jewish, but I don't think most people would realize that, who wrote novels about this. Does anything come to mind?
Ayn Rand,
actually, is the way to pronounce it. Did you read her novels? Did you ever hear of Ayn Rand? The Fountainhead? And that was her philosophy. She was an atheist. By the way, she's a brilliant woman. She wrote brilliant essays. But as far as this is concerned, she did not believe in God. She believed in man. She believed that man was the highest being in the universe, and was, in that sense, would be divine. And her greatest heroes was the architect, and that's the whole thing about the Fountainhead. He builds these tremendous architectural structures. All these architectural structures are symbolic. They're there to proclaim that we are the ultimate form of existence. That's exactly what the society was involved in. And this is what God, this is what they were doing, to make a name. A name means that we will be remembered forever. And we will set the standard for everyone in the future. That's what the idea of the name is all about. So then, of course, God decided to come down and to look at it, and now you'll understand what God said. There are one people with one language. Language is extremely important. You have to understand why God decided to confuse the languages. You know the role of language in terms of human relationships, in terms of identification. Whenever every profession, for example, has its own type of lingo. He doesn't talk. If you want to get anywhere in that group, you have to be able to talk the lingo. People laugh at a foreigner. He doesn't speak the language. He doesn't speak our language. If you want to express the fact that we get along together, we get along together. We speak the same language. When kids get together and they start their own little, I don't know if you can remember when you were kids, but you have your own club. You have your own passwords. Sometimes you develop your own language, your own way of communicating. So language is the most significant element in creating a feeling of identity among people. So that's what God said, that behold, if they all speak one language, which you would think would be a very, very good thing, but no, it's not a good thing. And they're all of one common purpose. That is to say that they've achieved such a degree of unity that now that there's nothing to hold them back from doing everything they propose to do, which means to say that everything that I brought about as a result of the flood to recreate man in such a way that he'd have a sense of humbleness, that he would not be carried away by this tremendous ego, all of that is going to be undone because they found a way to bypass that. And the way to bypass that is to band together and to create a new type of an ego, the group ego. If this is allowed to proceed, there's going to be nothing to stop them again. They're going to have this tremendous sense of being all-powerful, masters of the universe, and then they're going to just live any type of an instinctual existence. And the problem is this tremendous ego, and the only outlet for their aggression is against me, is against God. So this situation is intolerable. That's why God decided. It's a very interesting idea. I don't know how pleasant this is going to sound. But in order to preserve mankind, God created a situation where never again would mankind be able to achieve the type of unity, because that type of unity will always produce this feeling of deification and will create a situation where man's hostility will be directed against God, thereby making it impossible for man to be subservient, to even recognize God and to be subservient to the will of God. We've seen that in certain societies like the Soviet Union and, of course, Nazi Germany. But God then brought into play the conditions which would make it impossible for it ever to reach that level. Since that time, there have been emperors, there have been Napoleons, there have been conquerors. They have all been after the very same dream, to be able to achieve a sense of power which would give them that feeling of supremacy such that they would be the masters of the universe and they'd be able to negate God. They've never succeeded. Because the world was broken up into different nationalisms, into different units. So therefore, there'll always be enemies. There'll always be enemies at whom there'll always be an outlet for the aggressive impulses in man to direct against others. Now what this means, interestingly enough, is that according to the normal procedures of the world, you see that this has been one of the major problems. Nationalism is one of the main causes of hostility amongst nations. And that's, of course, the problem in terms of Israel and the Palestinians. If to try and solve it on a human level would not be that difficult, to try and create the conditions for the individual Palestinians to have rights and to have an economic life and so forth. But once it becomes a nationalistic thing, that they're not satisfied with that, but they want to have their own nation. See, that creates a situation of tremendous hostility. The factor of nationalism, whenever that's the motivating factor, that creates a sense of, I can't have any identification with the other party, and there's a sense of hostility. So the idea, what emerges from this is that the fact that there's always going to be hostility and strife and struggle among nations until the advent of the Mashiach. Let's say it like this, that the Torah maintains that world peace is possible. But if you try to achieve world peace purely through political means, like the United Nations, political arrangements, it's an impossibility. Because the nature of the situation as it stands right now is such that each nation, whenever a nation will achieve a level where it's able to express its hostility and to get a sense of mastery over another one, there's going to be war. Because there's no way that they can achieve this type of unity that existed before. Those conditions are gone. Because in order to do so, the only way you can have unity is to give up nationalism. And no, the world is not going to get together and decide to give up nationalism, and we'll just have one common universal identity and one type of currency and one type of language. It's just not going to happen. So therefore, as long as you have nationalism, you're going to have conflict. And of course, the goal of statesmen is to try and control conflict, conflict reduction. Obviously, we work for peace. But you have to realize that the working for peace, according to the ideas of this parsha, will always be limited. You'll have some years of peace, and some generations, in some centuries there'll be more peace and some less peace. Of course, you want to hope to achieve disarmament so that you can prevent a nuclear conflagration. But the idea that the world, left to its own devices, will achieve a situation of world peace is something which the Torah tells you cannot be achieved, and it wouldn't be a good thing to be achieved, because when it is achieved, it means to say that mankind has achieved a new universal ego, and all the hostility and aggression will be directed against God. But the Torah does talk about peace. There will be an era of peace. The entire goal of human history, in fact, is to to arrive at the advent of the generation of the Messiah, of the Mashiach. And the key feature of the period of the Mashiach will be that the world will be filled with peace. Now, if that's the case, the question arises, how it seems to be a contradiction. Because here we're saying that peace is a negative thing. And peace only causes, while it's good in terms of relations between man and man, but the ultimate purpose of mankind is to serve God. So if it's going to negate God, it's not a good. It's better to have strife and hostility, because as long as that's the case, there still exists the possibility that the world is subservient to God. So what's the essence of peace? It's stated in Isaiah. Nation will not lift up sword against nation. Why? For the world will be filled with the knowledge of God, as the waters cover the sea. But the only solution to the problem, the only way in which you can have a situation of universal identification, of universal peace, and it will not be something which will lead man to rebel against God, is if it's founded on the proper purposes. When the values of mankind will have changed, and all of the energies of man, all of the aggressive energies of man, will be directed towards the pursuit of the knowledge of God, that's going to be a completely different situation. See, that's the peace of the righteous. That we read this in the prayers on Friday night. Talmidei Chacham Marbim Shalom Ba'olam. That the scholars, true scholars, increase peace in the world. Because those who are motivated by the proper objectives, those who recognize the existence of God, and they devote all of their energies towards the knowledge of God and to inculcate people with the love of God, so of course they have no hostility against fellow man. They look at each fellow individual as an expression of the divine image, of the Tzelem Elokim. So that's the meaning of this story, in my opinion. And it gives us a profound insight into the historical development of the differences of languages, the fact that there's many, many languages, the fact that there's many, many nationalisms, and the truth of the matter is the fact that there's so much strife.